Jung posited that within each of us as individuals, there is a part of us that we repress. And there are feelings that we have, ideas that we have that we keep down, we push out of our consciousness. He called this the shadow. He also argued that if you wanted to become a truly integrated individual and a truly successful and fulfilled human being, you at some point had to recognize your shadow and admit some of those qualities into the way that you thought and those feelings that you had.
Hi, and welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change, hosted by myself, Ludvig Sundström, and Mikael Syding. In this second episode with Walter Kieschel, we continue where we left off last time in our discussion about strategy and Walter's popular book, The Lords of Strategy. In case you didn't hear the last episode, Walter has over 30 years of experience in the media industry, and among other things, he's been the managing editor of Fortune magazine and the editorial director of Harvard Business Publishing, which includes the famous Harvard Business Review. In this episode, we'll go in depth about the strategy consulting industry. For example, why does strategy consulting work? Why do people hire these consultants to begin with? What is the Jungian shadow of strategy? And what did business thinkers Tom Peters and Jim Collins tell Walter about the pitfalls of strategy consulting? We also learn why Walter thinks clients of strategy firms are becoming more demanding than ever before, and what this means to the future of the industry. Then Walter tells us about the difficulty of behavioral change in business and why companies that become the leader in one industry rarely make the transition into the next big thing. Finally, in the last 7 minutes, we all propose a different explanation for why Germany was the most successful industry for strategy consulting. Walter gives an economic answer, I give a cultural answer, and Mikael gives a historic answer. See if you can come up with a fourth explanation. That'd be pretty interesting. That said, let's continue our conversation with Walter.
Does strategy consulting still work? And in that case, why?
Oh, strategy consulting still works. I mean, strategy has been a great success in the sense that there's now an installed base, I think virtually everywhere in the corporate world, and that, you know, extends to Asia and beyond. I challenge you to go find a chief executive officer of a company of any size, whether in Europe, the United States, South America, China, Taiwan, Australia, and ask them the question, does your company have a strategy? And these days, I think you're going to find in almost every instance that they'll say, oh, yeah, okay, well, of course we have a strategy. Right, we have a strategy. If you find one who says, well, what strategy? I doubt that they're going to be in their position very long. Or, gosh, we don't really have a strategy. We're kind of thinking about that again. But now, virtually every corporation, organization, even small businesses knows they need to have a strategy. So the business for the strategy consultants in the 60s, 70s, and 80s even of helping their clients, typically large corporations, develop a strategy, that's done. And they can go in and help them change the strategy or adapt it. But if you talk to the people at Bain and BCG and McKinsey about their strategy practice, they'll honestly, and they're honest with you, they'll tell you that only a small percentage, probably less than 10% of the work they do these days is actually what they would describe as strategy work. And that may be for new businesses that the company is starting up or something. They have diversified into so many other lines of business, like helping out on the factory floor, operations management, thinking about logistics. They went through a big phase before the dot-com crash of helping companies adopt to the internet and online commerce. So strategy is still a part of their portfolio. And those three firms still pride themselves on being strategy firms and the strategy firms. And they would argue that as such, they can command higher fees, even if the work that they're doing is, you know, what's the best way to organize our supply chain in Kyrgyzstan, which it might be, actually, the work that they're doing.
But what's the deeper reason, would you say, for why the company and its directors and managers can't do this themselves? Why can't you see and understand what's in your own company?
That is a good question. And I think to the extent that they can't, oftentimes, it is because they have maybe grown up, if they've been with the company for quite a long time, with a set of assumptions, beliefs about the world, no longer really fitting reality. And so they need someone to come in and provide them with a fresh perspective on it. And then when they have that fresh perspective, they can think about strategy. Though these days, as I think I talk about in the book, there are more and more chief executives who've had have either been strategy consultants themselves or have studied strategy in business school, which they began offering courses in the 80s and 90s. But it is true that being in an organization, to some extent, kind of constrains your worldview. And so you may not need to see new competitors arising, or you may dismiss them. I think I cite the example of Henry Ford II, who was running the Ford Company back in the 60s or 70s. And all of a sudden, these small foreign automobiles, Volkswagens and Nissan, I guess they were called Datsuns in those days, and Toyota Corollas began to arrive in the United States market. And Ford just dismissed them. He called them, I'll euphemize this a little bit, or Beaudelaire, he called them little boxes of excrement. And he just couldn't believe that they were ever going to compete against his kind of car. It's a role of consultants to come in and help him see the realities and make the case. It's also true that consultants can, sometimes they provide technical expertise that the company just does not have itself. And they sometimes can help you overcome politics and divisional politics within a company. There are two examples I cite from, I don't talk about them in the book, but they actually came from Time Incorporated, where I used to work. In the mid-80s, Time realized that its models for predicting circulation of its magazines were really inadequate. They weren't working any longer. So they went to try to build more sophisticated models, and they found that they just didn't have the people in the building to do that. So they brought in the Boston Consulting Group, whose consultants designed a complete new model for predicting and managing the circulation of all the magazines. And in fact, it was so good that the company ended up hiring the two Boston Consulting consultants who were the head of the projects and installing them as the head of circulation. And then there was another, Time Inc. had many different magazines, but they typically didn't want to cooperate with one another on certain things like selling advertising. Now, we had advertisers like General Motors who said, look, I want to advertise in Time and Fortune and Money, and I want a special deal for working in all these, for advertising in all three of these magazines. And essentially, the people at Time and Fortune and Money on the business side would say, oh, well, no, we can't do that. We're not doing that. We're not. The Boston Consulting Group came in, they worked with the head of the magazine division, and they came up with something called the Maxi Plan, which enabled advertisers to buy advertising at a reduced rate in all three or four of the publications. And it was very successful. But I think only with consultants coming in and kind of knocking the heads together of the different division or magazine heads and sort of forcing them to embrace that kind of comprehensive and integrative plan, was the company able to do that?
Right. So those are two success stories, you might say. But on the other hand side, like you said before, a lot of the people in management and also CEOs have a background from different types of consulting. So they've been on the other side of the table. Do you think that makes it harder for future consultants to basically sell their services?
I think it does. I mean, certainly the clients are much more demanding. These days, from what I hear from strategy consultants or just consultants in general is, that if in the mid-60s or 70s, you could sell a project that was something like, well, let us help you develop a strategy and we think it'll take 6 months or something. Nowadays, the CEO says, I want to know, I want a project that will tell me exactly why we are selling 20% fewer toasters in Northeast Brazil than we were 2 years ago. And I want the results of that within 6 weeks on my desk. So much more focused, much more demanding, much clearer, and to some extent, more detailed. It's also true that one of the things that's happened is, of course, the rise of big data and databases. And information that consultants in the 60s and 70s would have and had to scramble for and take weeks to find and get now is available with a few keystrokes on the computer from systems that record all your financial information or your customer information. So that is another a way in which businesses that consultants were doing in the 70s and 80s now have really been supplanted or at least augmented by high technology.
I have one question about the growth share matrix here, but it's not specifically, before we get into, like you were saying now, in the 80s and so forth, you didn't have a sophisticated information gathering tools and you didn't have, you couldn't really model the data in a way that made it simple enough to work with for the top management. And that's kind of where the growth share matrix comes in, if I understand it correctly.
That's true. That's exactly right.
So before we go into this model, I have a kind of a follow-up question to that, which is, do you think there could ever be an equally successful, or has there been an equally successful business framework now that we have more information than ever before, but at the same time, we have more technology to kind of, we have data systems and we have computer screens and we have new models. So do you think there could be an as impactful model?
I think there probably are. I think there are probably these days called algorithms. I think there are many more of them out there. I don't think there is probably one algorithm or model that is as central to everyone's experience as the growth share matrix was to strategy back in the day. And I don't think that we're going to see a sort of transcendent or model or theory that is going to bring together everyone's thinking on business, just because there is so much different kinds of thinking going on in so many different places. And that's probably okay, probably a good thing. You know, I tell the story in the book because I reported it and heard it from all of the consulting firms, including not just the strategy firms. Back in the 60s or 70s, one of the great questions that they would use in talking to potential clients was saying to the CEO, do you know how much profit you make? Do you know who your biggest customer is across all your divisions? And do you know how much profit you make from that customer? And the CEO would oftentimes scratch his or her head and say, well, gosh, now that you mention it, I guess I don't. So the consulting firm would send in a team of 40 blue-suited MBAs. It would pore over all the company's accounting data from the different divisions. And then, you know, after 6 months, they'd present the results. I was sitting in a bar in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I don't know, 10 years ago, and SAP, the software firm, was having a regional meeting. And I was talking to one of the SAP sales agents, and I said, well, what are the, you know, some of the questions that you ask or you propose to people, potential clients? And they said, well, one of them is, you know, we ask them, do you know how much profit you're making from each of your customers and how big they are? Because once you install an SAP system, we can give you that information with just a few keystrokes on the computer. So, I mean, that kind of information is much more information on costs, competitors, and customers, much more readily available. And now there are companies need to develop the frameworks or the algorithms of their own to parse and decide how best to use that information.
But that's really the fundamentals of strategy consulting, right? To do the analysis on costs, customers, and competitors.
Yes, it really is. And that's one of the reasons I argue that strategy before the 60s and 70s really didn't exist. Though people talk about, oh my goodness, businesses must have had strategies. Well, no, not necessarily. And even the word strategy wasn't wasn't much used about businesses before the 50s and 60s. But it was the strategy frameworks that gave you an integrated way to look at your costs, your customers, and competitors, how they related to one another. If you were going to be the low-cost producer, then you were likely to face competition from these other low-cost producers, and you were likely to sell to this set of customers. That was the first time that many companies had a kind of systematic way of putting those three considerations together and thinking about them.
There's a quote. There's a quote from the book that I'm curious about, and I'm going to quote it now, which is that in the next stage of its evolution, if the paradigm is to evolve, strategy will have to come to terms with this Jungian shadow. And you mentioned this a couple of times throughout the book. Right. Could you explain what this means?
Sure. It's a reference to the work of the Swiss psychologist. You're probably familiar with Carl Jung or Jung. You can pronounce it better than I. And Jung posited that within each of us as individuals, there is a part of our personality, or there's a part of us that we repress. There are feelings that we have, ideas that we have that we keep down, we push out of our consciousness. This isn't exactly like the Freudian unconscious, but these are things that we almost deliberately don't think about or don't. There are feelings that we have, but we don't give them any expression. And we work hard to keep them from being expressed. And this is, he called this the shadow. He also argued that if you wanted to become a truly integrated individual and a truly successful and fulfilled human being, you at some point had to recognize your shadow and admit some of those qualities into the way that you thought and those feelings that you had. So what's the Jungian shadow for strategy? It is the whole dimension of people. It is the whole question about how do you best enlist people in your strategy, use them to help you construct the strategy, use them to help you carry out the strategy, use them as the resource, of course, which your strategy has to be through which your strategy has to be realized. It's a cartoonish oversimplification to say, and that in the world of management thinking, there are two kinds of people. There are the numbers people, and then there are the people. But there's some element of truth to that. The lords of strategy, the people who came up with most of the ideas about strategy were clearly numbers people. Most of them, with the exception of Bill Bain, they were all trained as engineers. Meanwhile, there was this whole strain of writing and thinking about business on the other side, exemplified in things like Tom Peters and Bob Waterman's hugely best-selling book, In Search of Excellence, or some of Richard Pascal's work on corporate culture, that all talked about how important people were, and that it can't be just the structures and the ideas, but you have to think more seriously about how do people that work in and incorporated in your strategy. And that, I think it's still true that there's not enough of that incorporation of the humanity of enterprise, or thinking about the humanity of enterprise, into thinking about strategy. I wrote, I think, in the early Fortune article about strategy, I went around and I asked the consulting firms, how many of your strategies really do you feel can your clients successfully implement? Can they carry them out? The companies didn't want to answer that question. They would back away and, well, hum and haw, I don't know, and everybody. They say, oh, everybody's got a strategy. If we've been in there, they've got a strategy. But, how many of them can? And the honest answer coming from most of them was probably fewer than five, certainly less than 10% of our clients can do that. And I remember Tom Peters responded to that report and said, it's not even 5%, it's not even 10%. What was the problem? The problem was that in those early stages of strategy development, the companies would develop the strategies just from the top. The consultants and the CEOs would sit around and think about, oh, this is what we got to do. Here's our strategy. They hand it down to the ranks, to the people who were in charge of carrying it out. And the people in charge of carrying it out didn't understand it, couldn't carry it out because of obstacles that top management and the consultants were unaware of. So the strategies just went nowhere. So the idea that you have to incorporate the humanity of the enterprise along with just the ideas, the concepts, and the numbers, And I think I quote in the book, I asked Michael Porter, who was the most famous academic expert on strategy and had these brilliantly successful books on it, well, what about people and that? And he sort of said, well, that's not really my area. That's really not my job. So that's the Jungian shadow, that if strategy is going to become fully integrated and successful, it's got to be able to acknowledge and bring in. Well, yes, they're very probably familiar to many of your listeners, but you were asking particularly about how do you build a media career. One of the things that I think is important for anyone in this economy, particularly if they want to do media work or creative work, is to also have some sort of fallback skill or a job that they can look to keep themselves alive and supported while they may be building their media platform or launching their next artistic project. You know, it could be a capacity to work construction. It could be a knowledge of how to cook or work in restaurants or bartend, but a sort of fallback position such that if your efforts, your projects are not paying out as quickly as you hoped, or your base of listeners or readers is not growing as quickly as you can, that you can do that and still keep the wolf from the door, as the proverb goes. The other thing, in preparing for this interview, I was thinking about discussions that my late wife and I had in the 80s and early 90s. Our first child, we have two children, our first child was a daughter. And when she was born and started to go to school, we began thinking about, well, what lessons would we like her to learn to be successful in the world? My wife was a federal civil servant for 27 years, always worked outside of the home. And I was editing articles on the glass ceiling and women's progress in management, and we both had observed a few things that we felt held women back, things that they weren't able to do. But I think it can be generalized to people of all genders. So we thought about three things that she needed to learn to do. I think that they're valuable not only for women, but for everyone in the current environment. We wanted her to be able to learn to tell a joke, something that in that era women weren't doing a lot of, to be able to give a speech or make a presentation effectively. And then thirdly, and maybe most difficult, to be able to take part of in an argument or a discussion or a heated exchange, perhaps in the workplace, without taking it personally, without thinking that the comments were comments necessarily on her. And I was talking with one friend about this list that we had cooked up, and he said, oh yeah, that's easy to do. Just make sure that your daughter, for at least two of the three, make sure that your daughter, when she's in high school or even university, goes out for the debate club or the Model United Nations, something where they prepare and argue different positions, because she'll certainly learn how to do make a presentation, and she'll certainly learn how to have an argument without taking it personally and see the other side of it. And I think those are actually still important skills.
I think I understand why those skills are important, but could you elaborate the underlying reasons for why those kind of communicative skills are so important?
Well, I think it is because face-to-face communication skills are vitally important. I think it is because we do have a tendency at work to not view it impersonally enough, but to view if some part of our work is criticized, to think it's to take it upon to say it's a comment on me and my self-worth, rather than just a comment on how well you wrote that article or prepared that brochure or led that project. It's difficult for people, particularly younger people, sometimes to get the requisite distance. And then it's a rare organization that really encourages their people to have discussions and not take them personally. There was a wonderful article, first in the California Management Review, then in Harvard Business Review, called How Top Management Teams Can Have a Good Fight. And these researchers who wrote the piece had studied high-tech companies on the West Coast, and they found that the most successful ones were places where the top 10 managers could get together in the morning and have an incredible argument about whether they should invest in this new technology or how this business was working or the others. And then at the end of the day, they'd all get together for a beer, or I mean, they maintain their friendships and their regard for one another, and they realize that hashing out different points of view, getting different perspectives on a problem, we're going to give them a better solution to it all the time. And in terms of making a presentation or telling a joke, those are about, aren't they, overcoming our self-consciousness, our worry about what others are going to think of us. By preparing yourself for how to deal with situations like that, you can help overcome those fears. It's interesting, in the 80s and 90s in the Harvard Business Review, the articles that people were most interested in were on strategy. In the late 90s, early 20s, it was about leadership, though that's less clearly defined. But in the aughts, it became articles on face-to-face management skills, how to have a difficult conversation, how to have an important conversation with people. And anybody who's working in an organization or with others should really be thinking about, how's the best way to have a conversation, listen to other people, hear their ideas, but also to find common ground and be able to put my own ideas across.
That's a good advice in itself, to find common ground before jumping straight to disagreeing.
It is, absolutely. I always found in my own discussions in managerial work that if we were discussing some idea perhaps that I had and my colleagues would ruthlessly criticize it and really destroy it, that the best way to move the conversation forward was to ask them, well, please give me a better idea. You can't just leave it at the criticism. Asking questions is almost always better than issuing diktats or commands.
Yeah, that brings us back to what you said about editing earlier, that you shouldn't cross out things, but rather ask a question and they will take care of it themselves.
Yes, right, exactly. And they'll probably come up with something better than anything that you would have proposed.
So I have two more questions about your book, Lords of Strategy. And the first question here is, what was the capabilities approach to strategy?
In the late 80s, in the mid 80s, people began to sense that positioning strategies where you positioned yourself, I'm going to be the low-cost producer in this market, or I'm going to be a high-end producer, or I'm going to have... that those positions were being competed away more quickly than ever before. And it was true that the industry leadership in a particular industry would change hands or be supplanted in a matter of 18 months rather than 3 to 5 years, which it would have been years before. So they began to think about, well, what would be more enduring? So C.K. Prahalad, Gary Hamel, in a couple of articles in the Harvard Business Review, they first came up with the idea of strategic intent, but that was kind of vague. But they also mentioned something called core competencies, that every company should have these core competencies. And that's what really, if you were really good at this and that and those things, that's what made you successful and would sustain you through seeing your market, your participation in different industries being buffeted. Capabilities was kind of the Boston Consulting Group's gloss on core competencies. It was an argument that, yes, you needed, but they couldn't just be like tactical competencies. They would include things like capabilities really like your brands or your ability to put together a whole marketing concept. The trouble with capabilities and why they didn't get very far was that companies couldn't agree on what their capabilities were, what their important capabilities were. And the consultants couldn't very clearly define exactly what a capability was or looked like. And so it was unlike a growth share matrix or an experience curve. It didn't have the kind of crispness and definition that enabled it to be put to work fairly readily.
So first, it's a harder concept to sell, but also because it's more abstract. But then also, assuming that you had sold the concept, it's also harder to implement because...
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Pardon me. How do you build up these capabilities? And again, that was a place where strategy ran into the problem of its Jungian shadow, because capabilities have to inhere in people. And if you're not having ways to think about them and the resources that they bring to the issue, then you're really going to be muddled in thinking about your capabilities.
So at the core of that, it comes down to behavioral change, and that's very hard.
It is very hard. Behavioral change is tough. I think I wrote a little bit about this in The Lords of Strategy, but I remember in my journalism at Fortune doing articles on corporate culture and how that could make behavioral change very tough. And the question I would pose to people is, what businesses can we identify where the company was in one business solidly and successful in that business, and then they made the transition into the next generation business? There's a wonderful book in one of the books by the McKinsey consultants on change about they put the list of who was most successful in developing vacuum tubes, and those three companies. And then you look at the companies that were most successful with transistors. Then you look at the companies that are most successful with microprocessors. And there's almost no overlap. Nobody who could make the jump from being a great vacuum tube company to being a great transistor company. And I would ask consultants and business people, can you identify some companies that have made this kind of change? And almost no one could. And in a few examples of companies that had done it, they had essentially had the same top CEO or maybe top two or three people, but they'd replaced everyone else in the company, because if they were going to go from being a cable television company to a media company, they had to get a completely different crew of people, which is another indication, as you said, that behavioral change is so difficult.
Right. So you have to put in order to create a new culture, you basically have to have new people.
Right.
Would IBM be an example of a company that has sustained and reinvented itself many times over without having to fire too many people?
In some respects, that's true. But the work of change at IBM is by no means finished. IBM was, its great success was as a mainframe computer provider. It famously missed the market in personal computers, let Microsoft be the developer of the software there, and lost that part of the franchise. Has tried to go on and reposition itself as kind of a service company. This is IBM. But I don't think that it occupies the same preeminence or success or trajectory of success that it once did when it was thought of as the most successful and best managed company in the world.
All right. As kind of a follow-up to the difficulty of behavioral change, you write in the book that Germany has been the biggest market for strategy consulting. And I'm wondering, first, why? And then I have some thoughts of my own.
Yes, I'd like to hear your thoughts. You probably know more about it than I do.
I think that may
be a somewhat dated perception. That was certainly true in the early days of strategy consulting in the 60s, 70s, maybe even in the 80s. And the usual explanation, I mean, at the one point, I think McKinsey and BCG each had something like 7 offices in Germany, and there were no other countries in which they had that many offices. The usual explanation given is that up until then, Germany had extraordinary education in engineering. It didn't have any particular higher education in terms of management. Didn't have any business schools, in effect. And that, to some extent, the engineers who ran not only the Mittelstand companies, but the larger German enterprises didn't have the sort of support of cadres of people like MBAs to help them do analysis and to think the kinds of thoughts that the strategy consultants wanted to help them think. But I think the situation may have changed now a bit, but I'd be very interested in your take, and you probably have a better explanation of why.
Okay. Okay, so you're basically putting forth an economic argument that the economic conditions were such that it simply made sense. You could kind of say that the invisible hand just made that push. On the other hand side, what if it was like a psychological and cultural thing, in the sense that the German people are more disciplined on average and more conscientious on average than other populations, so that they're like more willing to implement the advice you give them? They don't have to be held in the hand as much as many other populations would. So you basically give them advice and they trust you, and then they do it, and then they will get better results, and therefore it becomes a better market.
That could well be true. I mean, I think Germany, we think of these days, as still modeling very successful management employee relationships, and representation of workers on the boards of companies, and consultation with workers, and that certainly makes for much better the effectiveness in the organization. I love to quote it. I can't do it in German. The German maxim for manufacturing design, which one of the mantras was fewer parts. I mean, because of that wonderful German engineering ability, they're thinking about how to make things better all the time and improving them and so on. I guess I think it was that some of the German firms did not feel that they necessarily had a ways of thinking about large questions about what markets they should enter, where they were going to see competition from new technologies. So it was less, in their cases, about implementing the ideas or the strategies that they had than about sort of enlarging their thinking. But I mean, that may, I haven't looked at the strategy consulting industry in Germany and what they help them with now, though I know that they were still working with the German auto companies, probably still are, and a number of others. But no, I mean, certainly the good relationships that German companies enjoy with management and workers, and the discipline of German workers and focus is legendary and helpful.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, this is completely ad lib, if their experience with the world wars and the hyperinflation, if that somehow made the entrepreneurs and company managers more focused on the technical side of the business, and because you couldn't control the macro events, and therefore you were more focused on just making the best products, and that left the field wide open for strategy consultants.
I think that could absolutely be true. I think that's a very plausible and probably an important reason and thread in the discussion.
All right, Ludwig, do you have any final question, or Walter, do you have something you would want to finish off with?
I, having been able to deliver myself of that so important wisdom on career advice, and I don't have anything more to really add. You've been wonderfully well prepared. I originally thought this was going to be like some of the radio interviews I do in the United States, but thank you for the thoroughness of your preparation and the list of questions that you sent me, and it really did prompt me to go back and revisit some of the things that I've studied and study them anew. So I appreciate that.
And apart from your books, is there any way particular you want us to send our audience?
They can go through the lordsofstrategy.com website, and that'll reach me. But if people want to, that's probably the best way. That'll connect directly to my email.
That's awesome.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for being so well prepared and so good in your questioning and in your follow-ups and all of that.
Thank you, Walter Kieschel, and thank you for listening. If you learned something new about business thinking and the strategy consulting industry, please head on over to iTunes and give us a review, because that would help more people find the show. Also, be sure to subscribe to Future Skills on your favorite podcast platform if you haven't already. You can find links to all the popular ones, iTunes, Android, Stitcher, and Spotify, in the bottom of our episode descriptions. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.